I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We're asking questions of Dr. Scott Hardiman that you have. So you can comment them on our Facebook Live. You can comment them on our YouTube Live. If you have any questions that you want to ask, go ahead and comment them. We'll add them in right here. Doctor, thank you for coming on with us again. Great to have you back.
Thanks so much. Happy Monday.
Thank you. You as well. So we see surges in places like Texas, Florida. I think Arizona is one of them. I haven't heard the word surge necessarily associated with Missouri or Illinois. How do you feel about those locations that are seeing the surge, and how do Missouri and Illinois compare in your understanding?
Well, I think the places you mentioned, Texas, Arizona, to some degree California, Florida, of course, where the media and the focus has largely been over the past couple of weeks or so, they really didn't have that, quote, surge back in April, May timeframe, like we saw in New York, or really even to some degree in the St. Louis area where we saw our numbers sort of reach that peak. So they're climbing towards that now. Places in Missouri and Illinois, we've been really pretty steady. We've had, obviously, it's in the news a lot. We've had an increase in numbers of cases, but hospitalizations have sort of held steady, kind of up, down from day to day. So we really haven't had that big spike, although there's been quite an uptick in just the number of positive cases as well. Fortunately, they've been less severe and not requiring as hospitalizations like they were before. So I think what we're just seeing is in certain places, we're starting to see them just hit their stride, their peak, like we had a while back.
Dr. Hardiman, in your professional opinion, since we're talking about localized surges around the country, United States is a big place. It seems like we had this big, big hit with New York, and the rest of the country kind of responded in March all the same way. Do you think that it would have been wiser if we had said, okay, well, that's happening in New York, we'll wait until it happens here for us to sort of respond and shut things down instead of doing it as a blanket move?
A really great question. We knew so little about this in the big picture of things. I think from a modeling perspective, most of the country shutdown was based upon some epidemiologic models. As it's turned out, the vast majority of cases really fall in certain states and certain counties really across the country. And so I think it was an exercise to get prepared, not really sure what was coming. In hindsight, a more targeted approach would probably have been prudent. But it's awfully difficult to criticize when you see something new like this happen to know for certain how will it actually play out. Certainly now, I think with the testing capacity we have, and see, for instance, New York is really in very good shape, and their daily data is just fantastic compared to where they were before. Not that it's gone from existence there, but certainly much better. And in places that had a pretty good surge before, obviously those numbers have continued to decline. So if we have to go that route, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of appetite, certainly among me or a lot of other people in the country, that would really tolerate a complete shutdown again. But certainly a targeted approach to therapy with more testing and trying to isolate little pockets here or there. And just emphasize to people that a little bit of personal responsibility, that as you see cases bump up and testing get done, and certain age groups of people testing positive, do the right thing, isolate. A lot of people don't have symptoms. It's hard. I mean, it's mentally kind of a difficult thing to say. I tested positive. I feel 100% normal, or I just had the sniffles, to isolate yourself out and to try and slow the transmission a bit. But that's the type of behavior that, if people can do that, it will really slow down transmission, and we'll see those numbers drop back off again.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, a physician who comes to us every Monday and discusses the coronavirus as we continue to push through it. I want to talk a little bit about the process of get, you know, who needs to get tests, or how do you, you know, you've mentioned there that there are a lot of people who are asymptomatic. If you were to contract the flu, something that we all understand a little bit more than coronavirus, unless you catch it in time, as my understanding, like you can go in and get Tamiflu. But other than that, you hydrate, you stay at home, you maybe take some ibuprofen if you need to, but you stay at home and you get better. And unless there are, you know, certain things that happen that make you need to go get extra care from hospital. Is this the way it is largely for coronavirus patients where, I mean, you can get a test, but a test doesn't help you. It just tells you what you have. Like, who needs to go get tested? Who, if they feel uncomfortable, needs to just stay at home and keep to themselves and until they can get better? Like, what's your advice to those individuals who think, I might be feeling a little something?
Let me answer maybe two ways. Let me talk about the testing part first. So one of the tricky parts about this particular illness is that it has a little longer, we'll call it incubation period for lack of a better description, from time of a significant exposure to the time that you would either A, test positive, or B, manifest symptoms. So 3 to 5, sometimes 7 days or so. There's a lot of talk about 14-day quarantines when you've had an exposure, and that sort of works from the premise that you can develop symptoms out to 14 days, but if there's testing capacity, you can test someone 5 to 7 days into it and feel pretty confident if it's a quality test that they're going to be negative at that point, and then just closely monitor their symptoms going forward. So who needs to be tested? That's part of the issue is that right now there's a little bit of paranoia and panic out there that everyone who knows someone that had an exposure wants to be tested right then, and the tests are really, there's a lot of variability to them. They are accurate to a degree, but you have to put it in the whole clinical picture of things. So testing someone the day after they've had an exposure serves no purpose because they'll be negative that day, and 5 days later they may be positive and they get a false sense of security in there. So that's an educational issue, and physicians need to lead the charge on that and really try and help people understand what truly an exposure is. Was there source control, or was the person who has the infection wearing a mask? Were you as the individual wearing a mask? What was your distance? Was it a closed environment or not? And try and figure out who really is at risk in that situation, and then when to test and test appropriately based upon that. So certainly symptomatic people, people with a pretty solid known exposure at the right period of time, it warrants testing. There's a lot of asymptomatic people being tested. A lot of outpatient surgical procedures or medical procedures are being done, and by and large across the city and probably across the country, most of those patients are being screened with a COVID test prior to having their procedure done. So those are tests that they're sort of casting a net to try and pick up the ones and twos that turn up positive so that that person potentially, is, if they're asymptomatic, doesn't expose the healthcare team and require a shutdown of an ambulatory surgery center or imaging center or hospital OR, et cetera. So that's sort of the environment where people are being tested. To your question about influenza, it's a great talking point because the influenza is an illness that, by and large, when you get it, you get sick. I can't remember if we talked about this last week or not, but it's people generally are not asymptomatic from flu. Some, of course, are more symptomatic than others. Some get very sick. Some get mild symptoms, but pretty much everyone gets sick. There's a pretty narrow window of time to treat with Tamiflu, and so if you catch that usually within the first 24 to 48 hours, maybe 72, you can use Tamiflu to try and ease those symptoms. This is an illness that it seems as if a good chunk of the individuals who contract it have minimal to no symptoms, meaning 70 to 80%, studies go anywhere from 60% up to over 80% really have no symptoms by and large or minimal. And so that makes it a little tricky if they test positive because, again, like I said earlier, you don't really feel sick and it's hard psychologically to pull yourself back, especially after 3 or 4 months of being in a lockdown situation like that. So now you have individuals out there who groups of the population, about 20 to 25% of people who are the sick individuals. And so, you know, we shut down the economy, shut down things based upon an illness that, by and large, of those that get it, 20 to 25% are the ones that get sick. And we know that the vast majority of those who end up in hospitalizations or deaths tend to be in the over 65 population as well. So you pare all that down, and for the younger population, say 50 to 60 or less, the mortality rate is exceptionally low, and the symptoms tend to be fairly minimal. They're not zero. Obviously, this is a real thing, and you have to be very careful. But we also have better treatment options out there now and things that you can do in supportive care as we understand more about this.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman. He is a physician at Gateway ENT, also urgent specialist online at urgentspecialist.com. What about, I've heard people have a significant concern, if they go to get tested, whether they were to test positive or negative, but mostly if they were to test positive, who gets that information and what happens to it? Because I know people who are having to go get tested for their jobs because they work in healthcare facilities, but yep. I know other people who were associated with those individuals who are getting tested at a healthcare facility and thinking that maybe they wanted to go get a test, but they were worried about the possibility of A, testing positive, and B, then that information is out there. What kind of information is given to people, and where does it go?
So there's depending on the test location and where you go, if it's a city or state sanctioned testing location versus private testing facilities, the degree of information that's compiled ahead of time, there is some information that's necessary. Do you have a known exposure? Do you have any symptoms? Groups of people that you were associated with? That's really about it at most places. Certainly if there's large outbreaks or if there's a big group of people that kind of get tested together, that information tends to be gathered a bit. But largely it's positives and negatives that are reported to the state, and that information then is shared. There's a number of data collecting sites that do that, and it takes a few days for all that to work its way into the system. So you're kind of looking at running averages that you see. So daily reports from today are probably reflective of a little bit of gathered information over the course of the past couple of days or so. There are cases, obviously, if there's a big gathering, they talk about these, what they call a COVID party or something in Texas, where people said, let's just all get together and just see what happens, which is really shocking that someone would think to that level to do that. But they're going to gather that information. They're going to contact trace that, which is the whole premise of contact tracing, is trying to figure out there's large groups of people and how they can run that exercise out so that they can determine if they need to survey or keep an eye on other groups of individuals as a result of that.
So is it possible to test positive and keep it a secret, where you were to quarantine yourself for the 14 days and maybe identify, if you've been staying to yourself, maybe identify the few people you might have had contact with? Is it possible to do that? Or when you go to get a test somewhere, you're going to be providing some information to people that will be out?
I think you're going to be providing some information, but there's just no capacity within the state to run down or to track an individual. I mean, that's that personal responsibility level. If you test positive and you're a mom or a dad in a family, chances are that information doesn't make it any further other than there was a positive test. I am personally only aware of one group of individuals that were contacted by someone from the state wanting more information and or trying to find out if they were associated with a large gathering. The vast majority of people get tested, it gets reported as a positive, and that's pretty much the way it ends at that
Sounds
point.
Sounds like you so should go get tested if you have questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have symptoms for sure, I would not use that worry as a way to to not go get tested. And I understand where people are coming from. Obviously, there's some privacy issues and civil liberty of issues that are clearly at stake in situations like this. But don't mistake that for good health measure, for sure.
Dr. Hardman, one more quick question for you here. I don't know if you know how we're doing locally as far as hospital capacity goes, but I've seen reports that different cities in the country are experiencing, they're at capacity or they're close. Is that because we've delayed all non-essential surgeries and now those are happening alongside of COVID cases?
100% correct. Yeah. I mean, I think the reality is that hospitals and ICUs generally have a minimum threshold target that they look for. When hospitals function appropriately and kind of make sense for them financially, they're 75 to 85% at capacity. So we come off the tail end of 3 months of no elective surgeries and procedure being done, not to mention the fact that people have been hiding out at home, not seeking medical care, and we ramp those things up. I'd have to really dive into situations in certain cities and counties in Texas and Florida and Arizona right now, but a good chunk, as in 70% at one point, of the ICU beds, they were saying were not occupied by COVID patients. They might be nearing capacity, but a lot of that has to do with non-COVID-related issues, post-surgical patients, or people with other health-related issues like that. As far as St. Louis goes, we're not at capacity. I mean, it's definitely, there's most recent updates from the task force, 150 or so people, I think, hospitalized around the city. There's some under investigation here and there. Ventilatory capacity we're nowhere near that at this point. The numbers are still, despite upticks here and there and picking up more cases, not a panic situation or even considered a surge in the metropolitan area across the state, certainly as large at this point.
All right, Dr. Scott is going to stick with us for another segment, and I see a lot of questions coming through on the Facebook live chat and on the Annie Fry YouTube live chat, so keep them coming. We will fire them off to him here in just a minute. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for joining us. It is Monday, and we've got Dr. Scott Hardiman here on the line with us answering your coronavirus questions, and I've got a whole bunch of them from listeners here. Here's the first one I've got for you, Doctor. This is from Patrick on our Facebook Live. Why is it they stick a swab all the way up your nostril to get a test when a drop of saliva in the air can give you the virus? I think that's a fair question. Yeah. So tell us how that can be the case.
So the virus gains access largely through the nasal or oral cavity with some potential for contamination to the mucous membranes of the eye. It tends to hang there and replicate until the point where it moves down to the respiratory tree into the lungs, where obviously most of the damage seems to occur from this illness, at least initially on. So when you cough, of course, you're moving secretions out of those areas, or sneezing certainly too, moving secretions out of that area. Getting a sample, right now samples are largely taken from nasal cavity or the front part of your nose, and nasopharynx, which is the back part of the nose where they're sticking that swab, it feels like, to your brain. And then you can use saliva as well. So saliva has really grown in popularity recently because of a study out of Yale that talked about how the viral load was easily detectable. It's certainly a heck of a lot easier for patients to an oral swab, or producing saliva or even, you know, sputum or mucus from the back of your throat can see that as well. So any of those sources are legitimate. The theory is that if you can get enough of a sample from wherever you go, that you'll have enough viral load to be able to identify that.
Dr. Hardiman, a question from Joseph on our Facebook page. Is the spread so extensive now that there's really no mitigation or control? Is it beyond trying to control it?
No, I think, you know, still the number of, well, control is an interesting question, because it's what exactly defines that? You know, we're moving down this path of hoping to have a vaccine, hoping to have some level of herd immunity. At what percentage does that herd immunity actually hit? You know, still right now in the state of Missouri, of all of the people being tested, and there's a lot of tests being done, I think to date we've tested 535,000 people or so, give or take a bit. And right now the percentages that are positive are only around 5.5 to 5.7%. So again, some patients have symptoms, some patients don't have symptoms. So the hit rate with testing sort of shows us that really as a big percentage of those being tested, it's still pretty low. So it's not. I mean, we certainly even haven't hit any numbers of capacity to get to 10% of our population. And there is some evidence out there, some studies that are popping up from place to place now, that perhaps the number of people who've had this and or currently have it who are asymptomatic is maybe 8 to 10 times higher than what we'd normally see. But again, the idea is to slow down the transmission of it enough that it, A, doesn't overwhelm the healthcare system, and B, that allows us to quickly identify those that are most vulnerable and try and protect them, meaning the older individuals and those with other health-related issues. Sweden, we talked about this a long time ago, Sweden took a totally different approach to this, just inching towards herd immunity. So they had a different approach where they just left society open, and they saw a pretty dramatic increase. But based upon their projections now, they made a statement that their deaths would probably peak out around 5,000 to 6,000 based upon their population, that they felt like that once about 10 to 15% of their population became positive, that it would sort of start to burn itself out. And if the data and the information is coming through is correct, it seems like that's the case. I think their total, I haven't looked today, but over the weekend I think it was around 5,500 or so fatalities associated with this, which would, and it's been pretty stable over a period of time. So that would imply that perhaps you can achieve some level of maybe not true herd immunity, but slowing the transmission naturally with less of the population becoming infected. And it would be interesting to see what happens out of New York. Obviously, there's some pretty strict shutdown methods mm-hmm. in place still in New York, but their numbers have been very stable or decreasing substantially. And, you know, we don't really know what the exact percentage of population that's been infected there actually is at this point, just because it seems like there's less people getting sick currently. But it's not too late. I think we're going to be with this for a while. We just need to keep our heads about us and not be fearful of this, but respect the illness itself and understand who needs to be tested and how to care for those that are most vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading from Fox News right now that New York City has reported its first day in nearly 4 months without a single coronavirus death. That's something to be celebrated. Brad, on our YouTube Live, the Annie Fry YouTube page right now, says that he has a question. I heard Dr. Fauci mention that it's unlikely we will reach herd immunity. Isn't that the purpose of a vaccine, to assist in reaching herd immunity?
It is. You know, there's a lot of conflicting information about vaccines. There's some studies came out last week that said that there was some very promising evidence with some of the vaccine studies initially that the level of neutralizing antibodies that were produced by the vaccine in early phase studies were substantially high. And that makes you feel good that there is potentially options for a vaccine. It still has to be clearly tested and made sure it's safe and achieves the desired goal. But then, you know, you hear on the other side that there's evidence that perhaps the vaccine will only be about 70% effective. And, you know, we see that with influenza, and that there's some misses from year to year on the level of immunity that people achieve in the community, too. So herd immunity, naturally, generally we talk about that just from an epidemiologic perspective, at about 60 to 70% of the population would need to have some level of immunity to this. But if what we're trying to really do is slow down the transmission of it to the point that we can, again, isolate people and protect and, you know, pick up case clusters here and there, you may not have to get to full herd immunity to do that. Our capacity to test and to isolate are a lot better today than they were a few months ago, when it seemed like our only real hope was to, you know, somehow achieve herd immunity either through natural selection or through through a vaccine.
Rob has a question for Dr. Hardiman. He says, I'm an elementary teacher, likely going back to work in the fall. Considering we take all necessary precautions, what are the chances a third grader would give me the virus?
This is a great topic to talk about right now, timely-wise, as schools are really desperately trying to figure out a path forward. So there is a lot of evidence now. American Academy of Pediatrics is strongly urging schools reopen, although they've walked back a little bit of that and said to exercise some caution. There's two parts to that. One, of course, is protecting the kids, and two is protecting the staff, the teachers, and everyone else that works at the school. You know, it's an important thing to kind of identify now that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of evidence yet that kids are the vectors for this that are giving it to older individuals. In fact, I read a study last week that really talked strongly about the fact that in family clusters that it seemed like the parents were the ones testing positive, and later on the kids tested positive. You couple that with the fact that children largely don't get overly ill with this, whether that's through some difference in their immune system early on that protects them, or from potential cross-reactivity, some other coronavirus that they're seeing. It's a different perspective altogether. So the question there, I think, would be is you got to protect the teachers as well, but it seems like that the kids are not transmitting this to the older adult population as much as what was initially thought, which is why the schools were shut down very quickly early on. So I think schools are looking for a path forward. Most that I'm affiliated with and have talked with are ones that have a plan, a contingency plan in place that they're opening, and they have good concept in place of how they're going to survey that, monitor the kids, and then can move from there to some sort of virtual learning or hybrid model if necessary. But I think that there's emerging evidence all the time, and it seems to be growing, that the kids are not necessarily the ones that are the vectors for this. And I would just couple that with the fact that really daycares have stayed open this entire time. And while we've heard of an awful lot of outbreaks in nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities, which has been incredibly lethal and very sad to see that happen, we haven't heard of any outbreaks in child care facilities like that among the staff or among the kids. And other countries around the world have been able to keep their schools open with some good measures in place and have done well with the kids.
I want to ask you a follow-up question on that, and it's because I'm going to have a lawyer coming on in the next hour who's going to be talking about the Illinois High School Sports Association's regulations for resuming athletics, school sports. They have said that they want all students to be wearing masks at all time. If you're playing basketball, if you're playing volleyball in a gym, you're going to have to do the whole thing in a mask. And there, I have personally friends who have kids of this age who are very concerned about their asthmatic children wearing a mask while competing at this level. It's a pretty intense level. This isn't like fourth grade Y volleyball. Does it concern you at all to think about asking these student athletes to play at that high competitive level while wearing a mask the entire time?
To be honest, I just don't think that's really practical. Exercising at that capacity, if you can move air back and forth through the mask set quickly enough that it's not going to impede your athletic performance. The question is, what's really the reliability of that mask in stopping the transmission of aerosolized viral particles or even secretions for that matter? It's a really tough situation because I think all these kids want to go back. They want to play. They want to do things. But we're going to drive ourselves purely nutty because every time a kid tests positive on a team, every team member is going to be tested. Every coach is going to be tested. And every time that happens all throughout the fall sports season or winter for that matter too, it's going to be an ongoing battle to try and determine what do we do now? What do we do now? So it's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure really how that's practical. I understand why people would want to do it. Everyone's trying anything they can to try and slow the transmission of this down. But in a practical sense, it's going to be awfully difficult for kids. And I think it gives people a little bit of a false sense of security, too. I mean, you can imagine playing sports with a mask on and you're sweating. And, of course, all these masks lose their effectiveness when they get wet. And you're constantly touching your face. And you've just coughed into your mask. And now you've contaminated your hands. And you're touching other things. There comes that point where you think, how far do you take this? And is it really doing the good that it was thought to do to begin with?
I have like 10 seconds left here. But if you, like, what is the, if you have COVID-19, how long are you contagious?
Well, initially I had said that you can shed virus out to 30 to 45 days or so afterwards, but that doesn't necessarily imply that that's an active virus that could infect you. So most of the facilities, healthcare places, if you've had a fever and are no longer febrile for about 72 hours or so, you can return to work with a mask on. So if you're no longer have symptoms, usually 3 to 5 days, maybe 7 days after that, the risk of transmitting that to someone else is awfully low at that point.
All right, Dr. Scott Hardeman, I want everyone to go check out urgentspecialist.com. It's the best in urgent care in the St. Louis metro area. Go check it out. And if you need an ENT, you might be able to see him because they have specialists there ready to go. Great to talk to you again, as always, and always the good straight-up information. People appreciate it so much.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.